A race watch nationwide is a test of how well Democrats are positioned to take the Texas House of Representatives. What happened and why, coming up today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group, software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown. A closer look at the contest to replace an incumbent Texas House Republican in District 28. Why all the attention and what the outcome does or does not tell us about changing politics in the Texas suburbs. Also, with only days till the caucuses, where do Texans stand in the presidential race? Brand new numbers from the respected Texas Lyceum survey coming in, a PolitiFact check, and a whole lot more when the Texas Standard gets underway. And that happens right after this. No matter where you are, you're on Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. Great to have you with us on this 29th day of January. Hope you're having a great Wednesday. Hard to believe we're just a few days away from the opening bell in the 2020 presidential race, eh? You know, real-world people picking candidates. And where does Texas stand? Some new numbers just now coming in from the Texas Lyceum poll. You'll want to stay tuned for that coming up in just a couple of minutes. But yesterday, something happened here in Texas. An electoral contest to replace a Republican retiring early, a battle closely watched here and around the U.S. is a possible signal that after countless predictions, Texas is about to tip into the blue, or at least further from the red. All eyes have been on a particular Texas House District, number 28, in the Houston area. At least three presidential candidates got involved in this race. Activists at both the national and the state level committed hundreds of thousands of dollars to it. And the Texas Democrat with arguably the biggest name recognition in the Lone Star State right now, some fellow named Beto, made it his top political priority after ending his campaign for the White House. That's how big a deal this District 28 race has been seen. A race as a test for the proposition that Democrats are within striking distance of taking the Texas House of Representatives. And when the votes were finally tallied last night, well, here's where this story takes an interesting turn, or perhaps depressing, depending on your politics. Joining us now, Mark Jones, a political science professor at Rice University. Professor Jones, thanks for joining us on the Texas Standard.
Oh, thanks for having me on the show.
Republican Gary Gates decisively beat Democrat Liz Markowitz in this election runoff for Texas House District 28. Beto O'Rourke spent back-to-back weekends stumping in this district. What do you think Democrats saw that I guess the electorate didn't go along with?
Well, Democrats looked at the 2018 election and saw that Beto O'Rourke only lost to Ted Cruz in the district by 3%, and also saw that the demographics in the district are shifting in a favorable direction for Democrats. However, what we saw last night was something very different, in that we saw a pretty striking rejection of the Democratic candidate, Liz Markowitz, with Gary Gates defeating her by 16%. This is a district where Beto only lost by 3%, mm-hmm. and where the generic Republican only won by 9% back in 2018.
All right. Well, so I think some listeners might say, but it was a special election. You know, voter turnout was probably dismal. That wasn't the case.
No, this set a record for special elections in the Lone Star State. We had over 30,000 people turn out to participate. That smashed the previous record, which was 21,900 back in 2006 in Austin. So this was a race where we had massive turnout for a special election. And also for Democrats, they really crossed the Rubicon once they dropped about $2 million into the race and had Beto O'Rourke effectively living in the district, Julian Castro and Michael Bloomberg coming to do block walking, and Elizabeth Warren and Joe Biden intervening via endorsements of Liz Markowitz, the Democratic candidate.
All right, so how do you square the, I guess you could say, the conventional wisdom coming out of 2018 with what happened there in District 28 yesterday?
Well, this was a special election, so we don't want to read too much into it, but I think one thing it tells us is that those Beto numbers, we don't want to use those for anything. So just because Beto won a district or came close to winning a district, that's not very representative of true Republican or Democratic support in the district, and that we're better off using other numbers that show more generic support. If we look at those numbers, say Greg Abbott won this district by 15% back in 2018. Average Republican judicial candidates won it by 9%. That starts to square closer with the result we saw last night, although even that result was higher with Gates winning by 16%.
All right. Well, I know that there are going to be some Democrats in Texas listening to us right now saying, wait a minute, you guys aren't talking about those two other runoffs. There was HD 100 and HD 148. And by the way, the Democrats won.
Well, in 100, a Democrat had to win because there were only two Democrats running. There you had a pretty sad turnout. About 2,500 people turned out in a race for a deep blue district. And what we saw in 148 was Anna Eastman, that's here in Houston, defeated Luis Larrota in the special election there by about 30 points. And that's what we expect to see in 148, because that's a district where the natural Democratic advantage is about 30 points.
So, Mark, where does this leave Texas at the end of the day? Should we be counting on some surprises in November, or what do you think?
Well, Democrats are not going to give up. I think they still believe, and I think it's a realistic that there is a path to victory. It's a difficult path, but the prize in Texas is so great. That is, if Democrats can take control of the Texas House, they will have a seat at the redistricting table, mm-hmm. and will prevent Republicans from engaging in a partisan gerrymander that will provide tailor-made districts for Republican candidates. And that could be perhaps a difference of 6 or 7 seats in the U.S. House. And that's why National Democrats are so concerned about control of the Texas legislature, because they know that they can effectively get a 12-seat shift if they can get Democrats a majority in the Texas House after the 2020 election to provide a Democratic speaker in 2021.
What I hear you saying is that this could galvanize Republicans as much as Democrats.
Right. And I think that's one of the negative effects that Beto had in the HD 28 race. That is, Beto became so involved and effectively was living in HD 28 that he allowed Republicans to use him as a mobilizing tool. And so while he may help Democrats mobilize their base, he also has a sort of boomerang effect, and he helps the Republicans mobilize their base against his candidate.
Mark Jones is a political science professor at Rice University. Professor Jones, thanks so much for taking some time with The Standard today.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure.
Let's not leave the burbs just yet. If you live in Western Harris County, chances are that you're in County Precinct 3. That would mean your commissioner is Republican Steve Raddick. If that name sounds somewhat familiar, well, he's been on the ballot every election going back 32 years or so. But now Raddick is not running. And as Houston Public Media's Andrew Schneider reports, the big question here, too, is whether a fellow Republican will succeed him.
Here in the hallway outside Harris County Commissioner's Court is a string of photographs of commissioners and judges, past and present. The photos of the current court include that of a brown-haired man in his late 30s. That's Steve Raddick as he looked when he first joined the court in 1989. And just as Raddick has changed since then, so too has the precinct he leads. Former Harris County Judge Ed Emmett served alongside Raddick for nearly 12 years.
All the precincts have changed, but Precinct 3 probably has changed the most demographically, just because of the way the redistricting has been done over the years.
Over that time, Precinct 3 grew to more than 1 million people.
So it's a very diverse precinct now, and I think that will come into play.
Just how much and to whose advantage is another matter.
A lot of the communities that, you know, various minority communities really don't follow along party lines. They want to see solid improvements in their daily life.
If that's the case, it'd be decidedly different from what's happening just over the county line from Precinct 3 in Fort Bend County. There, one of the most diverse counties in the nation has broken heavily for Democrats in recent elections. Republican strategist Jessica Cologne says, despite its diversity,
Precinct 3 is still a Republican-leading precinct. I believe Trump won Precinct 3 in 2016 despite losing Harris County overall. And I think that's very indicative of where the heart and soul of Precinct 3 still remains.
Precinct 3 isn't quite where Fort Bend County is yet, according to Rice University political scientist Bob Stein, but it's getting there.
Maybe the best way to think about this is when Steve Roddick was first elected, that district was overwhelmingly Anglo, and of course it was overwhelmingly Republican. That's changed.
Anglos are still a majority, but they only make up about 53% of the precinct.
They're an aging population. So if you look at the period 2016 to 2018 to 2020, what you see is a slow exiting of an older, whiter, and Republican electorate.
Exiting being a euphemism for older voters dying off. David Mintzberg, a former Harris County Democratic Party chairman, sees all that as working in his party's favor.
This is an area that has been staunchly Republican, but the trend is such that it's moving to very competitive, and a number of Democratic office holders have fared quite well in this area of town in the most recent elections.
Bob Stein agrees. As evidence, he points to the 2018 election when Democrat Lizzie Fletcher flipped Texas's 7th congressional district, which overlaps Precinct 3.
In 2018, 17% of the electorate was under 25 years of age. Their share of the vote cast was 21%. They propelled candidates like Fletcher.
Still, Ed Emmett is convinced there's one thing that could matter as much as, or more than, demographics, and that's issues.
I do think it's all really going to come down to who the voters think can deliver on infrastructure and flood mitigation. You got to remember, a lot of that precinct got flooded in Harvey. They're still concerned about that.
It's an open question whom that will benefit, the Republican primary candidates, all of whom served through Harvey, or the Democratic candidates who did not. In Houston, I'm Andrew Schneider.
He's back, our social media editor, Wells Dunbar, that is. What are you seeing out there on social media?
Hi, David. Well, we're hearing from folks about the solid Republican win in the Texas House District 28th special election, which we tackled at the top of the show. We were eager for takes on whether the outcome there says anything about how the 2020 general election will go and more. Here's some of what we're seeing out there. Pointing to the uphill battle Democrats faced in that district, Paul Rutledge asks via Facebook, did anyone expect anything else out of this race? Joshua Bolton, he says he's thinking about what he calls wasted carpetbagger money from a National Democratic super PAC that sunk some money into that race there. Similarly, Jordan Peterson predicts that Democrats can say goodbye to a blue wave, while Susan Shefflow Spear, she laments the 20% registered voter turnout in that election. As usual, we get the government we deserve, she writes. Of course, 20% for
that's
a special election
high.
Actually being
that's a record high, folks.
As far as those things go, sadly enough. Well, you know, quick plug here, speaking of election stuff, that's some of the thing. That's one of the topics we tackled in the Texas Standard newsletter, which just hit inboxes this Wednesday morning. You can sign up for the Talk of Texas there on our website at texasstandard.org.
What? You're not signed up yet? You know what to do. Go over to texasstandard.org and make sure your name is on that list. We'd love to keep in touch with you every Wednesday. Hey, we'd also love to hear from you. Let us know what's making news in your part of the Lone Star State. Tweet us, won't you, at Texas Standard. Wells Dunbar is looking for you. He'll be back in 35.
Support comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org.
Hey, it's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. American Indians and Alaska Natives make up less than 2% of the U.S. population, an historically undercounted population, often called invisible. But as Texas Public Radio's Norma Martinez reports, some are banking on the 2020 census as a chance to turn things around.
Nearly 5% of American Indians in Texas were undercounted in 2010. The National Urban Indian Family Coalition was in San Antonio Thursday to develop a message that encourages an accurate count of American Indians. Rio Fernandez is Communications and Projects Director with NUIFC.
I think one of the things that we're hoping to figure out is how to best distill this idea that as the original people of this land, as the people that were here from the very beginning, we have a right to be counted, we have a right to have a say in the conversation that's going on that's going to affect us for generations.
He says an undercount will only deflect policies and programs that can improve communities. Carla Aguilar is Development Director for American Indians in Texas at the Spanish Colonial Missions. That's one of the organizations that receives funding from NUIFC. Aguilar says a sincere, heartfelt message is key to demonstrating how the census can directly impact community resources.
Because of historical marginalization and isolation that exists across the United States of American Indians, there's almost an unwillingness to fill out the census because people feel like they really aren't seen anyways, and why am I going to bother?
Participants in Thursday's meeting say an accurate count is vital to address issues like poverty, education, and housing inequality, which disproportionately affect the American Indian population. I'm Norma Martinez in San Antonio.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping companies protect their drivers on the road. More at worksafetexas.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Well, we are just 5 days away from what is considered to be the traditional start of the presidential primary season, the Iowa caucuses. And now comes a new evaluation of where Texans are coming down on the candidates as we move toward an important moment in this year's elections. The Texas Lyceum 2020 poll shows that among all the Democratic candidates, the one with the most support among Texans is not the one who would come closest to beating Trump in Texas come November. Come again? Joining us in the studio, Joshua Blank, Research Director at the Texas Lyceum Poll. Joshua, good to see you again, sir.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
All right. Before we get into the numbers, I suppose we need to talk a little bit about who's being polled, how they're being polled, and all the methodology stuff.
We can do a little bit of that, just okay. So nobody falls asleep.
Yeah.
The Texas Lyceum poll is a little bit unique in terms of polling that you're mostly going to see around election time, and that it actually surveys Texas adults, anyone over the age of 18, which is super important. So we survey 1,200 Texas adults, so that includes registered voters and people who aren't registered to vote. And for most of our policy questions, we're really interested in seeing what adult Texans think, because adult Texans are much more diverse and a much younger population than our registered voters, and really likely voters too.
So let's get to this Democratic sweepstakes here. Mm-hmm. I'm somewhat surprised by these numbers and the overall finding. Who is in first, second, and third? You want to do the honors here?
Yeah, sure. So first of all, from that full sample of adults, we pull out registered potential Democratic primary voters, of which we have 401, which creates a margin of error of plus or minus about 4.9%.
Okay,
technical talk done. So in that subset of the sample, we found Joe Biden in the lead with 28% of the vote, followed by Bernie Sanders at 26%. Elizabeth Warren at 13, late entrant Michael Bloomberg at 9%, Buttigieg at 6%, and Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar at 3%.
Boy, there's a lot of interesting ways you could slice that one up. I'm surprised that Bloomberg is doing as well as he is in Texas. Huh?
Well, I think that's a reflection of both, one, the fluidity of the race. I mean, to begin with, I don't think that we're really settled yet. I think after Iowa and New Hampshire, we might see some voters starting to coalesce a little bit more around the top candidates. But I think, again, Bloomberg is coming into what is still a fluid race, and he's also coming into a race with the ability to spend untold sums of money targeting voters. So, I mean, if you've been on YouTube at any point in Texas recently, it's kind of difficult not to see a Michael Bloomberg ad.
All right, let's get to the two front runners here. And I think this is where one of the top line findings is, right? Mm-hmm. You have Biden in first place among the Democrats, Sanders in second, technically speaking, although he is, I guess, within the margin of error. That's the phrase I'm looking for. But if you change the question somewhat, you say, which Democrat's going to do the best in a one-on-one against Donald Trump? What's the outcome?
Well, here we did a four-trial matchups between Biden and Trump, Sanders and Trump, Warren and Trump, and Buttigieg and Trump, who at the time were sort of the four top-polling Democrats nationally. And the one who performed the best was Bernie Sanders. Now, I think what you're seeing here is a couple things. Number one, Sanders has seen a bit of a surge nationally, and I always remind people, Texas is still part of the United States, and so we're seeing some of that surge here. But what really struck me in the findings was Sanders' strength among two key groups here. Number one, 18 to 29-year-olds, and that's very large, you know, have a big factor in the Democratic primary potentially. Right. And then number two, and this is especially part of the trial ballots, among Texas independents. Well, every other candidate we tested was beat by Donald Trump among Texas independents. Sanders was ahead of Trump by 3 points amongst this group. In general, we've kind of avoided or ignored independents in Texas for a long time. And what I mean here is people who don't identify with either the Democratic or Republican Party even a little bit, because the elections have been so lopsided. Republicans have easily won most statewide offices. I think Now, after the 2018 elections, and we saw a much closer than expected race at the top of the ticket between Cruz and O'Rourke for U.S. Senate, now I think we're starting to pay a little bit more attention to this group of voters who've traditionally trended Republican.
Okay, I know a lot of our listeners are going to want to know whether or how or if the impeachment brouhaha is playing any role in determination of who people are going to vote for in Texas come November.
You know, in this poll, as in many others, both in Texas and elsewhere, impeachment attitudes are really crystallized, and they're crystallized based on your partisanship. And so in the Lyceum poll, we saw about an even split between voters who think that Donald Trump should be removed from office by the U.S. Senate and those who think that he shouldn't. Partisanship drives most of that. But having asked many questions about this over the last year, these attitudes have not moved.
Are we seeing any sort of a bleed through when it comes to attitudes about national politicians and, say, local politicians? I'm thinking of Governor Abbott in particular.
You know, Governor Abbott looks really good in this poll in a lot of ways. He has, you know, the highest job approval compared to him. So we look at job approval for Greg Abbott, the president, and also Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick. And you know, Governor Abbott actually enjoys high job approval really pretty consistently. And what that's driven by is, you know, obviously astronomical job approval amongst Republicans, similar to the president's in the 80 to 90% range. But the difference is that Abbott still gets pretty high marks from Texas Democrats. So there's usually about 30 to 40% of Texas Democrats who also say Governor Abbott's doing a good job. And part of that is the fact that the governor deals with natural disasters. He deals with tragedies, shootings. And in the end of the day, I think a lot of people, you know, even if they have problem with the government in Texas, Democrats in particular, they still like living in Texas and they still think things are going pretty well here. And Abbott is the figurehead of that government.
You know, there's just not enough time to get into all of these numbers, but we're going to put up an executive briefing over at texasstandard.org where you can find out a little bit more about the discoveries in the 2020 Texas Lyceum poll. That's where Joshua Blank is research director. Joshua, good to see you again, sir. Thanks so much for stopping by.
Thanks for having me.
Retired Texas teachers expressing sticker shock over a report in the Austin Statesman that the teacher retirement system appears to be paying a base rent for downtown office space of $326,000 a month. That jaw-dropping figure just now coming to light as the TRS fought to keep it secret for 7 months and continues to fight releasing other cost details. It's got the attention of at least one Texas lawmaker who's overseeing pensions, Dan Flynn of Canton, calling for the TRS to back out of the deal as a commitment retired teachers can't afford. Coming up on 29 minutes past the hour.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Rand Group, partnering with small and mid-sized companies by helping to unify their businesses and achieve digital transformation. More at randgroup.com. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. Houston-based company Kinder Morgan says it's reached a milestone on building its 430-mile natural gas pipeline planned to run through the Texas Hill Country. But as KUT's Mos Bouchel reports, opposition to the project continues.
One of the challenges to building a pipeline is securing the right-of-way to have it run through private land. Now Kinder Morgan says it's obtained that right for the full span of the project. To be clear, some landowners may still bring legal challenges against the company if they're unhappy with the terms decided through eminent domain courts. But while that happens, the company says it now has the right to access land and begin construction. Alan Foer is VP of Public Affairs for Kinder Morgan.
It is an important milestone on any project in Texas and anywhere, is once you have that 100%, all tracks are prepared for from the land component piece for construction is a significant milestone.
The announcement comes the same week that Hays County joined Kyle, San Marcos, and the city of Austin in a lawsuit challenging pipeline construction through the Hill Country, claiming that Kinder Morgan did not obtain proper permitting to build the line through environmentally sensitive areas.
That's Mos Bouchel reporting. Universities in Texas are limiting travel to China due to the outbreak of coronavirus. Texas A&M and the University of Houston announced changes Tuesday. The University of Texas at Austin recently added China to its list of restricted regions. An African-American historic trail in Texas is a step closer to receiving a national designation. Houston Public Media's Sasha Cordner reports President Trump signed a bill this week to study the Emancipation Trail from Galveston to Houston.
The federal study would look at the migration route newly freed slaves took in the 19th century. Doris Ellis Robinson is the founder of Friends of Emancipation Park in Houston. She's also the president of the Freedmen's Town Preservation Coalition. Both groups help spur this legislative effort.
Where did the slaves go when they were freed? What happened and how many of them went to Mexico? And I think the study will delve into that.
If it receives a national designation, the 51-mile Emancipation Trail could be the second of its kind in the U.S., focused on the experiences of African Americans. The bipartisan bill was sponsored by Houston Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee and Senator John Cornyn. I'm Sasha Cordner in Houston.
The head Border Patrol agent for the Del Rio sector in Texas is now the agency's deputy chief. Raul Ortiz's new role was announced Tuesday. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from Project Innovate, inviting photographers of all levels to share their unique perspective of Texas. Top submissions will be showcased at the Dell Experience at South by Southwest. Details at projectinnovate.com/Texas.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. The impeachment of Donald J. Trump has given more than a few of us the opportunity to revisit some of the finer points perhaps forgotten from civic class back in the day. Remember, it's Article 1 that gives the House of Representatives the sole power of impeachment. Wait, a sole power? W.F. Strong has been thinking of a time when the impeachment duty hit a little closer to home.
It's hard not to like the down-home folksy style that made Texas Governor Jim Ferguson so enormously popular 100 years ago. After all, he was known as Farmer Jim. He often said civilization begins and ends with the plow. Ferguson was a mesmerizing speaker and storyteller, and was splendidly fluent in the dialects of rural Texas. As historian Cortez Ewing pointed out, Ferguson was the voice of the people. And with his sixth grade education, he promoted the idea that he had not suffered the damages of higher degrees. He said some professors took 3 years to learn that you couldn't grow wool on an armadillo. His constituency, he claimed, resided where the creeks forked. And he felt they were getting shortchanged by not getting enough basic education while the kids at UT were getting too much of it. He said, you know, those kids, they go up to Austin for 4 years, and they return home with nothing but a mandolin and liver damage. As my brother Redneck Day would say, that right there is funny. I don't care who you are. He did some good things. I suppose the best of the things was substantially increasing the funding for public education in Texas and creating a Texas Highway Department, even though he later raided the funds with impunity. His style loses its charm when you learn all that was revealed at his impeachment. He claimed to be a successful businessman. He was not. He claimed to be painstakingly honest. He was an embezzler. He was an avowed enemy of the KKK, but to hear him talk about black people, you'd have thought he had earned his hood. There were two major parts to the impeachment charges brought against him in 1917. The first had to do with his abuse of power while attempting to micromanage the University of Texas. The second had to do with his utilization of the Temple Bank he had controlling interest in as his personal slush fund. The UT battle was the one he should have avoided. It proved his undoing. Basically, he wanted five professors fired for the unstated reason that they had spoken out publicly against his candidacy for governor. He told the UT president, Dr. Robert E. Vinson, that he wanted them fired. Vinson asked what they had done to deserve it, and he said, I don't need a reason. I'm the governor. When Vinson refused to fire the professors, he went after the Board of Regents to get them to do his bidding, and when they wouldn't, he started replacing them one by one and withheld state funding from the university to force it to obey his orders. Well, this led to a special session being called by the legislature itself to press for Ferguson's impeachment. Well, here's where Ferguson made his first greatest legal blunder. The legislature, you see, cannot call itself into special session. Only the governor can do that. So to prove this to them, he called a special session to consider UT funding he could sign. While there, legislators legally took up another matter, impeachment. And here Ferguson made his second blunder. He showed up most every day to his own trial, invited or not. He gave a speech in his own defense and blamed the charges on that N-word-loving senator from the North, Senator Johnson, not Lyndon. I've cleaned that up for you. He took the stand on his behalf and was mostly a weak and contradictory witness, unable to explain discrepancies. The fact is that he had parked state funds in his bank for personal gain, and he had run his bank as a one-man Ponzi scheme. The Senate found him guilty on 5 charges relating to mishandling of public funds and abuse of power in relation to the university. The vote was 25-3. But the day before the conviction was certain to come down, Ferguson cleverly resigned, claiming then that they couldn't uphold an impeachment for someone who wasn't actually in office. Well, this was a vital point to him because the impeachment barred him from running for any office in Texas for life. So, he had his wife run in his place, and she won. One final note of incredulity. In her first term, Miriam Ma Ferguson, as she was known, had a law passed that gave amnesty to all Texas officials formerly impeached. Of course, her husband was the only one the amnesty applied to. She even used the word Christian in the law, implying that Christian forgiveness was appropriate here. That is why I so often say, I'm W.F. Strong. These are stories from Texas. Some of them are astonishingly true.
W.F. Strong is Fulbright Scholar, Professor of Culture and Communication, University of Texas, RGV. Check out more of his stories from Texas on iTunes or wherever fine podcasts are served.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. Families can save for tuition, room and board, books, and other qualified education expenses at eligible schools nationwide. Learn more at texascollegesavings.com. Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, whose research has helped bring more than 90 cancer-fighting drugs to the marketplace. Patients can access national clinical trials phases 1-4 in their communities. More at texasoncology.com.
My name is Ibrahim Ahmed. I have been in Texas since 2001. There's a pretty vibrant Muslim community. It has grown over the years that I've been here. I am very comfortable in my identity being gay. I had always wanted to be a part of a community that was LGBTQ and Muslim, but I didn't know how to go about it. Someone had spoken. His name is Faisal Alam, and I heard his speech, and he said that being the change is what can bring something out in the world. So then I decided that, you know what, if I want a community, I have to be the change. I have to be LGBTQ and Muslim. My dream is to have the LGBTQ community. Everyone, every single person in the community, I know it's a tough dream to be accepting of Muslims, regardless of what's happened. Just because someone's actions doesn't define it for every Muslim. And speaking to the Muslim community, to not be judgmental, to be open, to be willing to understand the LGBTQ community and hear them out and stand in solidarity with them. My name is Ibrahim Ahmed, and you're listening to the Texas Standard.
Minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. If you find yourself in need of a trip to the emergency room in the rural West Texas town of Presidio, the odds can be stacked pretty high against you. The local EMS crew has effectively one ambulance to cover 1,500 square miles. From outlying communities like Candelaria and Redosa, the ride to the hospital alone can take close to 3 hours. But there's another less obvious hurdle that can delay first responders in getting to you in this remote part of the state. Marfa Public Radio's Sally Beauvais has that story.
Presidio EMS,
eavesdrop on a police scanner in rural West Texas, and it's quieter than somewhere like Abilene or Midland. But when emergency calls do come in, the stakes can be unusually high.
If they're in cardiac arrest, you got a limited time to get there and start CPR.
Isidro Pondo is an advanced EMT with Presidio Emergency Services. When he gets a call, scenarios like this one start running through his head.
If you don't, they run that risk of brain damage, and if you do bring them back, there's a chance that they're going to have some type of disability for the rest of their lives, or they're going to be on life support.
But as Pondo's on his way to the patient, he's often navigating another more immediate problem. Trying to find them.
It's frustrating and it's embarrassing when you go to the wrong address and you realize that you're on the wrong side of town. Now you got to hurry up and make it to the other side in town. And it's a nightmare.
Presidio EMS and police say it happens regularly. Dispatch relays an address, they rush to the scene and find they're in the wrong place. And it doesn't just happen in the more remote communities nearby. Often it's right there in city limits. Pondo remembers one time when that may have made the difference between life and death.
It was a cardiac arrest and they wouldn't answer the phone when we tried calling them. And what should have taken us 3 minutes took us about 15 minutes to get there. By then it was too late.
Pondo grew up in Presidio, and he's been an EMT for almost 10 years. He's frustrated this hasn't improved. At this point, you may be thinking, okay, why is it so hard for EMTs to find people in Presidio? Turns out this happens all over the country. Several years ago, the federal government ordered cell phone carriers to improve location technology for the benefit of people who call 911. But problems persist in rural America. A 2017 study found ambulance wait times in rural areas are almost double the national average. In Presidio, there are layers and layers of issues standing between ambulances and people's front doors. To demonstrate, EMS Director Melinda Richardson took me out for a drive in her Subaru.
Let's pretend that you have received a call to 411 Rosedale.
She emphasizes this is just a hypothetical example, but an especially good one. In Presidio, there's a Rosedale Avenue, a Rosedale Drive, and a Rosedale Street. Luckily, on this call, we know which one we're looking for.
411 Rosedale, Presidio, Texas.
I'm entering the address into Google Maps, which is also what Richardson's crew uses to navigate to unfamiliar houses. We get going.
Turn right onto Bledsoe Boulevard.
Okay, so is this Bledsoe?
No idea. No street signs.
No street signs. This is not Bledsoe.
She says spotty signage is just the tip of the iceberg.
Head east on Commerce Street toward Harmon Avenue, then turn left onto Harmon Avenue.
Okay, this is another example. Harmon is the old street name. Ralph England is the new one. So Google Maps has the old street
name. Turn left onto Harmon Avenue.
The city renamed a handful of streets to honor U.S. veterans almost 10 years ago. Google Maps hasn't caught up yet. There are other discrepancies. Some houses have duplicate numbers. Some houses don't have numbers at all.
You've arrived. Should this one be 411?
This one should be 411, but I don't see a house number on that particular house.
This brings us to another problem. Here and in many other rural areas, street names and house numbers are a relatively new phenomenon. Richardson says many Presidio residents don't actually know what their official address is. They might have one assigned by the gas utility, another from the telephone company, and those might be different than what the city has. A local ordinance requires residents to post house numbers. But Richardson says,
it's difficult to ask people to put a house number on their house when you may come back a month later and go, oh, wait a minute, you know, now we've got better information and so we need to change that house number, because it's not just changing a number on a house, it's changing it on your driver's license with your bank. It filters out into a lot of different areas of your life.
That's a lot to ask, especially if you don't know what your 911 address is. That's the term the city uses to refer to your official physical address. According to Alma Martin, chair of Presidio's Planning and Zoning Board, people often don't even think about this until they need an ambulance to show up.
Do you know where Alma Martin's house is?
Martin Street and her home are clearly marked, but I still got lost using Google Maps trying to find it.
I really, really want to get our 911 addresses in order.
Martin says before the times of smartphones and car GPS, physical addresses weren't really a part of life in Presidio. Residents relied on P.O. boxes for mail, and the town was smaller and closer knit. Everyone knew where everyone else lived. But times have changed.
You can't get an ID card, you can't get a driver's license without a physical address.
when the local effort to assign 911 addresses began over a decade ago, it wasn't a seamless process. Houses and neighborhoods fell through the cracks. Martin wants this to change soon.
We really need to get the word out that people need to look at their water bills.
That's where Presidio residents can find their actual city-assigned 911 address. But even those aren't perfect across the board.
Emergency services and law enforcement are not looking for a water meter. They're looking for a front door.
Martin's proposing a boots-on-the-ground volunteer effort. She wants her committee to go door-to-door, block by block, to try and straighten out cases of address confusion. And just recently, the city of Presidio secured funding to dedicate a part-time person to this task. Martin hopes they can all work together and once and for all ask people to
put their number on their front door for ambulance services, for fire departments, for law enforcement services, for the poor UPS guy, the FedEx guy.
It'll be a lot of work, but she says once it's done, maybe the city can even contact Google.
You've arrived.
Lost in Presidio, I'm Sally Beauvais.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you.
Hey, you're listening to the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Governor Greg Abbott is back again with another claim about homelessness in the Texas capital city, this time saying that the city of Austin has, quote, removed seemingly any legal consequences to the actions where the homeless lie, sleep, where they defecate, close quote. Now, is that a fact? Here to hash it out, Madeline Meckelberg with PolitiFact Texas, based at the Austin American Statesman. Madeline, welcome back. Good to see you.
Good to see you, too.
All right. So this is not the first time, far from it, in which the governor has weighed in on Austin's homelessness policies. What's the context for this particular statement?
You're exactly right. We've seen him talk about this time and time again and criticize the city for its policies. In this case, he made this claim earlier this month after a man stabbed one person to death and injured others at an Austin shopping center at the beginning of the month. Police later identified the man as a person experiencing homelessness, which prompted Abbott to make this claim to reporters at the Capitol later that day. And he said, I'm quoting, "What Austin has done over the past half year is to perpetuate a sense of lawlessness in the city by the homeless. They have removed seemingly any legal consequences to the actions where the homeless lie, sleep, where they defecate."
Now, I'm pretty sure that Austin has made some changes to its ordinances when it comes to the homeless, right? I mean, there used to be a rule that if you were homeless, you couldn't sleep on the sidewalk, for example.
Right. You're exactly right. And this whole debate started last June when the city decided to change its policies about public camping. Mm-hmm. And this was their first version of the ordinance. It was definitely the most lax. And they said, basically, public camping, except for in parks, is legal as long as the person doing it isn't endangering the health and safety of themselves or other people, or making it hazardous or inconvenient to walk by somewhere. So people could sit, sleep, panhandle on public sidewalks. It was fine. But there were still legal consequences for people who violated this policy. It was a misdemeanor. So they expanded the areas where people were allowed to sleep or lie in public, but they kept legal consequences in place for violators.
I see. Now, I think the most glaring thing that the governor had to say in this had to do with defecation, right? So mm-hmm. Is there any talk about where someone can relieve oneself if one is homeless?
So, no. I mean, this is not one of the things that Austin has changed when we're talking about changes to the homeless policy.
Right.
That's in a separate statute. It's not related to public camping.
And it relates
camping.
To absolutely anyone.
That's right. So no matter what changes were done to the homeless policy, this section is still in place. You cannot urinate or defecate in public. That's a Class C misdemeanor, as it has been.
So that has not changed.
Is there any sort of distinction between lying down and sleeping? Is one like camping, or is one like occupying a public space, or any of that?
Sure. So I think in the context of Abbott's claim, he was kind of referring to them as all in one category together. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We saw the city clarify its language about this a bit in its second version of this camping ordinance that they came to in October. Mm-hmm. That included a lot more specific language regulating where people could lie, where people could sleep, and what public camping actually was. But the biggest change that came with that policy was a more clear outline in place for law enforcement and how law enforcement can actually enforce this ordinance. Essentially, when police officers come upon someone who's sleeping somewhere where they're not supposed to be, lying somewhere, public camping where they're not supposed to be, they give that person a warning. They tell them, you're not supposed to be camping here. Here are some areas where you can legally go. And they're supposed to give this person a certain amount of time to relocate. They also can contact city officials who can connect them with public housing openings and things like that. And only after all that time, if a person does not change their behavior and relocate and stays in the same spot, then they violate the policy and it's still a Class C misdemeanor, which is punishable by a fine of up to $500.
Do we have enough information for a ruling on the governor's statement?
I think we do.
All right, well, hit us with it.
We rated this claim false.
False. Governor Greg Abbott's latest claim about Austin's homelessness policy, saying that the city has removed seemingly any legal consequences to the actions where the homeless lie, sleep, where they defecate, close quote. That ruling, according to the good folks at PolitiFact Texas and Madeline Meckelberg, who is heading up the fact checkers there. Madeline, good to see you again. Thanks so much for stopping by.
Thank you for having me.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Social media editor Wells Dunbar is back in the studio. What are Texans talking about on this Wednesday, Wells?
Hi, David. Well, here's a story that has folks talking. Starting in the fall, new UT Austin students will need to show proof that they've been vaccinated against measles. The background here, Texas doesn't currently require measles vaccinations for college enrollment unless the student is studying in a health-related field. But with this announcement from the 40 Acres, UT Austin is requiring them for all incoming students. The context here is pretty obvious with global health concerns on the rise. A UT spokesperson says the university wants to keep students healthy and in class. Many applauding the news on our Facebook page, mostly all in support. Carla Herring, Boys Venue, she says, vaccinate, even adults. I've had adult staff come in with childhood diseases just from contact with children. Think about student teachers, social work interns, and field placements, not just students in the medical field. So interesting development there, mm-hmm. What with the concerns about global health issues
Got
on the rise.
That it could be challenged, however. We'll see what actually happens.
Well, speaking of challenges, controversy surrounding the novel American Dirt. We've been covering this story, thriller about crossing the U.S.-Mexico border that's been accused of cultural appropriation. Controversy continues to rise. Yesterday, we had the director of the McAllen Public Library on to explain her decision not to participate mm-hmm. in a promotional campaign surrounding the book. Now, another Texas development, the Blue Willow Bookshop in Houston, Texas, has canceled a previously scheduled event with the author. On Twitter, it wrote, after much consideration and discussion with the book's publisher, our event with Jeannie Cummins has been canceled. It was our hope to have a meaningful conversation about the book and the crisis on the U.S. border, which affects our city deeply, but it has since become clear to us we could not deliver on the event we had envisioned. And we've seen some other cancellations of author events there in Texas and states elsewhere in the United States. So a story that continues to rile folks up. Interesting comment here on our Facebook page from Charles Consual. He writes, in Horizon City outside of El Paso, we have no library at all. Fortunately, the Houston Library reached out and helps. It sounds like this library in McAllen is looking out for Texans as well. Take your focus off Oprah for a minute and celebrate a Texas library that refuses to be coerced or bullied. So, again, another story that folks are continuing to watch there that is getting some traction, continuing traction on social media.
It seems that the conversation around the impeachment drama, you know, which has largely been sort of experienced by proxy through television mm-hmm. and on radio and that sort of thing, seems like something's happening there on the Capitol grounds. The New York Times reporting that protesters are gathering outside of the Capitol as the opening arguments end, Trump's defense team discounting Bolton there, the revelations from the New York Times, which have been hotly contested, you know, question of whether to have witnesses testify in the impeachment trial in the Senate. It'll be interesting to see where this is going. But right now, as it stands, it appears that this protest happening outside of the Capitol, according to the New York Times. It's one of many stories that we continue to track here at the Texas Standard. And you know, the news continues online at texasstandard.org, where you can sign up for our Wednesday briefing. Don't forget to do that while you're over there. We're out of time for the big broadcast, but we're going to be back here tomorrow. Till then, I'm David Brown, along with Wells Dunbar and the rest of the Texas Standard team, wishing you a wonderful Wednesday.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Holdridge, Adrian Killam, the George Huntington Family, and St. David's Foundation. Additionally, Texas Mutual Insurance Company is a founding sponsor of Texas Standard.